It is Tuesday, November 27th, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Support for KUAF comes from the University of Arkansas Bookstore and its Holiday Appreciation Day for U of A faculty and staff, Tuesday, December 4th. Razorback apparel, gifts, and more will be offered. Store locations include the Garland Avenue Bookstore, the U of A Student Union, Northwest Arkansas Mall, and Pinnacle Hills Promenade in Rogers. uofastore.com for more information. Support for KUAF also comes from Walton Art Center, presenting jazz trumpeter Sean Jones Saturday at 7 and 9 p.m. This 21st century jazz musician is labeled as one of the most expressive and gifted players of his generation. Tickets and more information available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600. Ahead on Ozarks, the debate over the resources directed toward charter schools. Jacqueline Froelich examines the role of the charter school in Arkansas. We'll also preview December's local theater offerings, including the latest edition of the best Christmas pageant ever at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. First, the general election may have been 3 weeks ago, but voters are again at the polls today to determine the winner of a handful of runoff elections in the area. Registered voters wishing to cast their ballots in still undetermined races will generally vote at their usual precincts. For more information about today's runoff elections, you can call your local county clerk's office. City and county governments in Washington and Benton counties are moving to withdraw from a regional hazardous materials response team. The regional hazmat team started 23 years ago. Fayetteville Fire Chief David Dayringer says that the regional approach was taken when hazmat response was a new responsibility for county and city governments.
So they formed this interlocal cooperation council of the communities and county governments in Washington and Benton County and formed a regional hazmat team because no one entity, no one government, no one fire department had the training or the resources or the number of members who were hazmat technicians to handle an incident or a spill.
The chief says things have changed in the fire service industry in the past 2 decades and that a regional team for responding to incidents involving hazardous materials is no longer a necessity.
It's something we can do for ourselves with the resources that we put into the regional team, and we're already handling our own hazmat incidents. And now we have a statewide mutual aid plan, you know, the Arkansas State Fire Chiefs Association, and it's part of the master emergency plan for the state of Arkansas. So we have the means, we now have the training, we now have the personnel and the equipment to take care of hazardous materials incidents.
The switch to local hazmat response should have a neutral budget impact after startup costs are absorbed. Chief Dayringer says that startup costs will include purchases of a hazmat truck, more hazmat suits, containment barrels, and other specialized tools. The technology offices at the University of Arkansas have been reorganized over the past few weeks in a move meant to shorten the time it takes for research to go from the lab to the marketplace. Jim Rankin is the Vice Provost for Research and Economic Development at the Fayetteville campus. He says historically, the UA Technology Office has been a collaboration between the Fayetteville campus and the UA System Division of Agriculture.
What we've done is decided to split that up a little bit so that there will be one unit focusing on division, and then we've got one unit focusing on campus. We've changed the name to Technology Ventures because we're trying to change our focus a little more away from the patent and licensing. That's still an important part, but we want people to realize we're interested in doing startup companies and commercializing this technology. So that's more what we want to represent and kind of a new approach for the office.
Rankin says splitting the office to individually serve research efforts at the Fayetteville campus and the Division of Agriculture will benefit each entity as well as the state as a whole.
There'll be a little more focus on each particular area. So there will be one group focused strictly on division, one group focused on campus. From the campus side, we're going to really get out, do a lot more outreach to faculty, show them why it's important that they look at commercializing their intellectual property and, you know, how we can commercialize and create more jobs in Arkansas.
Rankin says on the campus side, a smaller staff will make it easier for faculty to know with whom they need to communicate in order to take the research to the marketplace. The Springdale School District received some good news yesterday. As we reported last month, the district was one of several in Arkansas that applied for funding from the federal Race to the Top program. Yesterday, the U.S. Department of Education announced that Springdale was one of 61 finalists in the $400 million grant program. According to a Department of Education release, the finalists were chosen from a pool of 372 applicants, and that between 15 and 25 winning applications will be announced by the end of the year. If awarded the grant, Springdale stands to receive between $20 and $30 million based on the district's population. A majority of the money would go toward expanding technology in the district, but the grant would also go toward expanding existing family literacy and after-school programs, as well as support curriculum writing work and implementing more of a personalized learning plan for students. The University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences is working to notify about 1,500 patients of a file breach from the first half of 2010. The hospital said yesterday that a former medical resident who was fired took records home. Leslie Taylor with UAMS says no financial information was disclosed in the breach and affected patients have been notified.
We just want them to know that this information is out there. It is protected under a court order because the former medical resident is involved in a lawsuit against UAMS, and so it now has been sealed by the court. But because that information was out there, we just are required to let people know under federal privacy laws.
Taylor says UAMS learned of the breach through a lawsuit filed by the medical resident and that the documents have been sealed by the court. The university disclosed in April that information from 7,000 patients had been disclosed in a separate breach. Ozark Regional Transit is getting into the spirit of the giving season. Yesterday, the regional transit company announced that all passengers can ride its buses for free during the month of December. Except, of course, on Christmas Day, when no routes will be operating on the holiday. Clear, low in the upper 20s tonight. Tomorrow, clear, a high of 57 in northwest Arkansas. Lower 60s, the high tomorrow in the Arkansas River Valley. And for Wednesday night, clear, lows will be in the mid-30s. This is Ozarks at Large. The purpose of public charter schools is to expand school choice, test innovation, and help raise grade-level proficiency, especially in low-performing minority districts. That's why some say charter schools are flourishing in Arkansas. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, detractors claim charter operators are creaming both top students and tax dollars away from traditional districts.
Charter schools are publicly funded, independently operated, tuition-free experimental institutions. Arkansas charter schools were first authorized by the State Board of Education 20 years ago and are held accountable for student achievement and are monitored by the Arkansas Department of Education. Mary Perry is the Arkansas Department of Education's Director of Charter and Home Schools.
Charter schools, the purpose of charter schools is to offer choice to parents and students, to be able to have innovative practice and to be able to operate without some of the rules and regulations of traditional public schools.
Traditional public school funding per student is around $9,300 in Arkansas. Charter schools receive less per student, a third less, plus no facilities or transportation funding. An estimated 2 million students are enrolled in more than 5,000 charter schools nationwide, making up 5% of all public schools, 2% in Arkansas. We have 18 open enrollment charter schools, with three more recently approved. Some are chartered specifically for college prep, others focus on performing arts, and some push science and technology. 12 school districts operate 14 conversion charters. Those serve just students within those zones. The number of charter schools was fixed in Arkansas, but last year the state legislature allowed for a floating cap, currently set at 24. Again, ADE Charter School Coordinator Mary Perry.
So it will always increase by 5 when it gets within 2.
Which will gradually expand the number of charter schools around the state.
And sometimes charter schools are closed for lack of achievement, and sometimes they're closed for financial reasons as well.
Quite a few Arkansas charter schools have been shuttered as a consequence. All must periodically renegotiate their charter contract with the state. Little Rock counts a concentration of charter schools serving predominantly African-American districts. In the Northwest Arkansas, Benton County School of the Arts chartered 10 years ago, and Haas Hall Academy in Fayetteville, founded 8 years ago, draw from predominantly white districts. This afternoon, a class of blue-uniformed scholars, which is what students are called here at Haas Hall, study journalism. The school's recently expanded its quarters in a retail complex, says founder and superintendent Martin Schopmeyer.
Haas Hall Academy is a STEAM school. It's a science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics institution. Our focus is to make sure that our scholars are prepared to go to college.
Haas Hall is the state's top academically ranked charter. It has 328th through 12th grade students from across a dozen school districts. It's 20% diverse, primarily Asian, African American, and Hispanic, and has a wait list of more than 2,000.
So a scholar has to apply online or their parents apply, and then they meet with me. They shadow so that we can make sure that they like the school. And then we do a lottery, and that lottery is completely random and anonymous. There's never talk about grades. There's never talk about anything like that in any of the conversations. It's to answer questions about the school.
Haas Hall Academy's charter was recently renewed for the next 10 years. It's also the least funded charter in the state at $5,600 per pupil. The Academy receives donations from parents and philanthropies, most notably the Walton Family Foundation. It's a successful, independently operated charter with 100% graduation and college enrollment rates. But many charters are operated by nonprofit management groups with names like ESTEM and KIPP, an acronym for Knowledge's Power Program. Both offer college prep for disadvantaged students. One more, Responsive Ed, a Texas-based charter company, was just approved to open a school in Bentonville next year. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's District Charter Collaboration Compact encourages school districts to sign a pledge to collaborate and share resources with local charter schools. And a number of charters in Arkansas received money from the Walton Family Foundation, which invested $159 million in education reform last year nationwide. But Diana Ravitch says these foundations are working to privatize public education.
I think they're in it because they believe in the free market, and they got very rich and very successful in the free market, and so they have decided that their ideas and their values should be imposed on public education, and I believe that they're completely wrong.
Diana Ravitch is research professor of education at New York University. She served as assistant secretary of education in President George H.W. Bush's administration and was part of the nascent school reform and accountability movement. But several years ago, she shifted. Her most recent book is titled The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education.
Charter schools there are some very good schools, not a lot of them, but there are some very good charter schools. There are some really awful charter schools. Most charter schools, and this is what I think almost every study shows, that most charter schools are no better if they have the same kids than the neighborhood public school. So for a state, it's not a win-win. It's actually just dividing up and having a dual school system.
Charter schools, by their nature, screen out the neediest students, she says.
Because those kids never apply to a charter school. Their families are too dysfunctional. They're too stressed. Either they have a broken family, someone's dead, someone's in jail. The parents are just not looking for a charter school. They're just looking to survive. And the charters have another advantage over public schools, and that is, first of all, they can exclude kids they don't want. They don't take. They usually don't take an adequate share of kids with special needs. Many charters have been sued for excluding children with special needs. And they tend not to have a fair proportion of kids who are English language learners.
Ravitch says charter schools tend to be proficient because they attract students seeking to be proficient.
So you have to ask, in a state like Arkansas, which is a relatively poor state, why would you want to have two school systems? Didn't you learn anything from the era of segregation, that having two school systems impoverishes both, and that we're better off having a public school system where the community works together?
Last year's Arkansas benchmark exam show on average 83% of 3rd through 8th grade students scored proficient and advanced in literacy, 78% in math. And while many charter franchises boast top marks, most state charter school students measured at or slightly above state average scores at the elementary and middle school levels. Still, a couple of high school charters are performing higher, most notably Haas Hall Academy and KIPP Delta Charter Schools. Max Brantley, senior editor of the Arkansas Times, critically reports and blogs about charters.
Every national study that's been done so far has suggested that charter schools don't have a magic wand, that there's some good and some bad, and on the whole, public schools do as good a job as the charter schools do. What's bad is that they provide flight for favored classes in difficult areas. They're particularly damaging to struggling urban school districts that are trying to hang on to middle-class student populations. And in Little Rock, for example, the schools that they financed here have drained middle-class students who tend to be whiter than the other students out of the districts.
The Gallup poll, for the first time last summer, asked Americans to rate educational institutions. 78% said private schools provide the best education, followed by parochial and charter schools. Public schools were ranked at the bottom after homeschools. For decades, liberals pushed school choice, but today, conservatives favor it. And with a Republican majority running the Arkansas General Assembly in 2013, Max Brantley expects a surge of enabling legislation for charter education.
Well, it's pretty clear that the Walton money and the money from other people who think like they do has succeeded in electing a legislature that is heavily in favor of their agenda on what they call more choice, what I call more damage to the existing egalitarian public school model. And what that will mean is probably a further lifting of the cap on creation of charter schools in Arkansas. But I think one of their first big pushes is to attempt to reduce or take away entirely the State Board of Education's ability to review charter schools. The State Board of Education, after some benign neglect in the early years, has become very vigorous in reviewing charter school applications and performance of existing charter schools. I think they've been doing a good job, although they've approved more charter schools than I would have if I sat there. What's at work here eventually is the outsourcing of education, whether for profit or to the belief of the backers of it that somehow corporate management is better than public management. It's an overturning of the American tradition of the great hallmark of American society, this egalitarian public school model open to all comers, and where the government attempts to promise that everybody is treated and served equally. And I think in the end they're going to be tremendous losers. It's going to create wastelands in urban cities, I'm afraid, already has in some places.
That only the most active parents and capable students tend to seek out charter schools is a problem that needs addressing, admits Gary Ritter, a professor of education policy in the University of Arkansas Department of Education Reform. But the specter of wealthy interests driving charter school proliferation will, in the end, he says, provide certain parents with options to which they've never had access.
My own personal experience, while anecdotes are only sort of interesting to me, they don't matter. But my own personal experience is I have kids in Catholic schools, in traditional publics, and in charters. And I'm glad there are those options here because different schools fit for each of these students.
For example, Professor Ritter says, Bentonville's new charter school will offer an intimate alternative to students who feel lost within the burgeoning 15,000 student district.
And indeed, there's some evidence that when charters open up in areas and when there are choice options, often the traditional public schools respond positively by creating a better academic environment because previously, you could deliver whatever academic environment you wanted, and the kids would come because they had no other choices.
As for draining much-needed money from public school coffers to pay charter school management organization administrative fees, Professor Gary Ritter says if a child becomes proficient, the expenditure is worth it. Plus, he points out, traditional schools also have management overhead, like paying lawyers to appear before the state board to argue against charter schools, all part of the standard cost of conducting the business of public education. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The National Association of Charter School Authorizers, the NACSA, is launching the 1 Million Lives Advocacy Campaign tomorrow at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., to enact stronger state policies to maximize the development of more high-quality charter schools, as well as to ensure prompt closure of persistently failing ones. The goal is to place 1 million more children into 3,000 high-performing schools over the next 5 years.
On the next Fresh Air, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. We talk with Gregory Johnson about his new book, The Last Refuge. It explains the rise, fall, and resurrection of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which continues to plot attacks against the U.S. Johnson is a former Fulbright Fellow in Yemen and works in the Near Eastern Studies Department at Princeton University. Join us.
Fresh Air, tonight at 6 on KUAF 91.3 FM. This is Ozarks at Large. When the Arkansas legislature meets in regular session early next year, one of the big drivers of figuring out the state's budget will be Medicaid and a possible Medicaid expansion. Nearly 250,000 Arkansans could gain access to health insurance under a Medicaid expansion, including an estimated 80,000 parents. That's according to a new study from Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. Recently, Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business sat down with Rich Huddleston, the executive director of Arkansas Advocates, for a discussion about Medicaid and Medicaid expansion.
The study indicates there's 80,000 parents that are either partially Medicaid eligible or could be covered by Medicaid expansion. We've heard the number 250,000 thrown about in terms of just the total population. So tell me where this 80,000 kind of fits into the 250,000 population.
Sure. I mean, of course, not all the adults that are going to be eligible for the expansion are parents. And so, you know, but there is a big chunk of them that are. And this is really just an historic opportunity to provide health care coverage for a first segment of adults, many of whom are parents, that under any other case they would not have health insurance. And so,
of the 23% that are eligible already but don't do it, why do they not enroll? They don't know, or they don't want to, or what's the excuse?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of factors. Arkansas has a reputation on the adult side for adults just not being eligible for Medicaid unless you fall into a disabled category or something like that. And so Arkansas actually has one of the lowest eligibility levels for adults for Medicaid in the country. And so I think of the adults that are eligible for Medicaid, many of them just don't know that they are.
Some legislators in particular have said that we need to shore up the current Medicaid program, which obviously has some holes, and we're going to get to a little bit of that in a second. We need to find some solutions to the program at its current level before we start talking about expansion. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, what's wrong with that argument is that moving forward with the expansion would actually help with the Medicaid shortfall. According to a study by DHS, moving forward with the expansion would actually reduce some state costs that we're already paying, like for uncompensated care, for low-income adults who have to go to the hospital and the hospitals have to eat that cost. Would also bring in some new state tax revenue. We're projecting about $800 million annually. I mean, new federal funding would come to Arkansas, and much of that will roll over in the Arkansas economy at the local level and actually create new state tax revenues. And so DHS estimates are that for the first year alone would result in state savings of about $39 million just moving forward with the expansion. Second year, $89 million. And I think over the first 7 years, roughly $372 million in state savings as a result of the expansion. So this would actually reduce the budget shortfall.
Does this because the new Medicaid money that could roll in from the expansion, it goes to some areas where we already have deficiencies, or does it exclusively take care of an area of the population that is not covered right now?
Well, the savings are actually going to be felt in a number of different areas. And so for example, there are some Medicaid categories right now that we're paying a higher federal match rate for. We'll be able to move some of those folks over to a different program as a result of the expansion, so that will actually reduce our cost. I mentioned the uncompensated care costs for hospitals. The state is also spending some money on the uninsured. We'll be able to reduce that. And so across a number of different areas, so it's not just one particular population other than just uninsured adults. But its impact is going to be felt throughout the Medicaid program.
Let's talk about the current state of the program, the fact that it does have a shortfall right now. It's kind of a moving target for me to even understand what the number is that we're truly in the hole. We've heard 250 to 400 million. We got some more specific numbers this week, but I'm still not sure I'm clear on it. Are you clear on what the actual deficit might be at this point in time?
Well, you're right. The number has changed, and I think the number they presented the other day, I think, was roughly $358 million for next year. Of course, as you're going to talk about, the governor has proposed some ways to help deal with that. And but I think it's a moving target. And of course, you know, things change over a year's time, and both in terms of the economy, a number of people that we're paying for. I mean, so there are a number of factors why that number changes.
Yeah. Right, right. Well, let's talk about the Band-Aid that Governor Beebe rolled out this week. There were some cuts to some specific programs. He asked that some programs not be eliminated, but there were certainly some places that took some big hits, particularly at nursing homes and the Level 3 funding. He also revised the budget forecast for this current fiscal year and miraculously found about $200 million in some growth revenue when you look at what has probably already been collected in the first 6 months of this fiscal year and what's projected to come in the next 6 months. What's your reaction to this Band-Aid that the governor has at least started to address?
Well, I think his revised projections are definitely good news for us, because it does reduce the size of the shortfall. I mean, it also comes up with some new money to help pay for it. In terms of his proposed cuts, he had some really tough choices to make. I mean, because if there's not going to be any movement to raise new revenue to help shore up the gap, and of course, we're one of the groups out there that are now starting to talk about, you know, trying to raise new revenue. I mean, we know that that's going to be tough to do. I mean, the governor did not have a lot of easy choices, because every part of the Medicaid budget is supported by a group. And so, I mean, so he did not have many easy choices to make. He did do a 3% across the board cut in provider reimbursements. And so that does impact, you know, pretty much all providers. But the downside of that is that Arkansas generally has some of the lowest reimbursement rates for providers in the country. And so providers are going to take a big hit, and that's going to make some of them economically a little unstable, because they're really operating at the margins.
So you guys are interested in pursuing potential new revenue tax increases. What would you be looking at doing?
Well, I think there's not going to be like one magic bullet that we're going to have to look at. I think we're going to have to spread the pain out among a number of taxes. I think we need to make some changes to the soda pop tax, to maybe add some things. And that's not going to bring in a lot of revenue, but some. There's still some things we can do around internet sales taxes, believe it or not, that would raise some new revenue. Of course, we've long advocated for closing corporate income tax loopholes, where corporations get to shift part of their income to other states to avoid paying Arkansas taxes. And then I think we need to look at expanding the sales tax base as well. And so I think it's probably, you know, four or five things that we might need to do. But, you know, they're going to be tough to sell politically.
You'll have a tough fight on your hands on that one. Let's talk about some of the other political dimension of this debate, and that is that you do not talk to a single legislator who does not tell you, I do have problems with the Medicaid expansion, but I also understand that it will bring more money into my legislative district. It will help my hospitals, my nursing homes, my medical clinics, my health clinics. How are they going to juggle all of that? How is a legislator going to wade through and balance, do that tightrope walk?
Well, I think the first point that they're going to have to say is that the Affordable Care Act is here to stay. I mean, I think that was clear with the recent national election, and so that's not going away. And so we have a choice to make. Do we move forward with the expansion? And in many of these small rural counties, you might have 1,000 people uninsured, 2,000 people uninsured. This is going to be a unique opportunity in some of these rural counties for legislators to say, hey, it's a choice. Are we going to, you know, cover the uninsured folks in my county, many of whom I know, or not, because the alternative is to basically not move forward with the expansion and let other states use all the federal money that we're going to be sending out. That's really generally a good deal for Arkansas anyway, because we always get back a lot more in federal dollars than we send out.
Roby Brock talked with Rich Huddleston, the executive director of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, earlier this month. Full disclosure, my wife, Laura Kellums, is the director of the Northwest Arkansas office of the same organization. Support for TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from four offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. And Verizon, offering a wide selection of productivity-enhancing tablets for small business, including the Ample iPad. More information at a Verizon communication store near you or online at vzw.com/smallbusiness. And CEG Partners, using empirical data to better understand your customers' experiences and their loyalties. More information at cegpartners.com. C Museum Hotel in Bentonville is a combination boutique hotel, contemporary art museum, and restaurant modeled after the flagship 21C in Louisville. These unique hotels have come to house a unique group of residents, penguins. Well, at least sculptures of penguins. Each hotel has its own flock, and local residents can vote on the color of the flock coming to Bentonville's hotel. Last week, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke with Emmanuel Gardnier, general manager of the 21C Hotel in Bentonville, about the voting. She began the conversation by asking about the story behind the penguins.
The penguins were discovered that they are actually their art creation of a group of artists in Italy called the Cracking Art Group, and they exhibited it in Venice, and our founder actually found them there and fell in love with the art pieces and started to showcase them when we opened our hotel in Louisville. And the public really, really enjoyed them and started to play with them. It's kind of whimsical pieces we have. And basically, due to popular demand, we actually decided to turn them into our logo and mascot.
So there is a flock of penguins at each of the museums?
Yes, we have a flock of penguins. They are outside, they are on the roof, and inside the buildings, and we move them constantly. You'll find them in front of your door, in the elevator, or maybe on the treadmill, or having a drink with you at the bar.
Oh, that's so much fun.
That's a whimsical part, is our guests actually play a lot with them, too.
So what can you tell me about the group, the artist group, the Cracking Art Group?
They are Italian artists, and they decided to repurpose actually plastic and basically reuse plastic to create art pieces, which are nature-based. And they have, obviously, the penguin. We have snails. Actually, we had a snail collection in the square in Bentonville in the month of June. That was kind of very popular. So they have actually a lot of different animals.
And speaking of the Bentonville Hotel, you guys are allowing people to vote on what the color of the flock of penguins here will be, and the options are orange, fuchsia, and green. So how did you come up with those colors?
Those colors were chosen to complement the architecture of our building. And our architect, Deborah Berkey, was very instrumental in choosing the different colors. One of the things with 21C Museum Hotel is every hotel has a different color penguin. And so we decided, because our snail exhibit downtown Bentonville was so popular and so loved by the public, we decided to involve the public in choosing the color.
And people can vote on this at facebook.com/21CMuseumHotels. They have until Thursday, November 29th. What is the value of having these penguins at the hotel? It's a very unique hotel in itself, but what is the value of having the penguins?
It really represents our collection and who we are. It represents contemporary art, and it also represents the fact that art can also be fun and whimsical.
The museum is set to open in the first quarter of next year. How soon can people expect to see the penguins?
Well, we'll reveal them in the final color on Thursday, November 29th. And after that, we plan to kind of an unveiling sometime, beginning of the year. In the meantime, actually, we're going to have a job fair in Fayetteville next week on Tuesday and Wednesday at the Student Union building. And we're going to bring our three penguins. So you'll be able, anyone who wants to see them, they'll be in the Student Union building. room 514, where we stage our job fair.
So the penguins are already ready. It's just a matter of what color?
Right now, we only have the three different colors. So people can see them, they can touch them, they can go to Facebook and vote for them. But, we have, three samples in our office right now.
Oh, excellent. So if people want to know exactly what these colors are going to look like, they can come check you guys out at the union.
Yeah, and after that, we'll be back in our pre-opening office in Bentonville. And we're going to have also other job fairs in Bentonville in December and January. And the penguins will definitely be with us.
Well, fantastic. As someone who's been working behind the scenes on the museum and things and getting ready for it to open and getting ready for the penguins, what are you most looking forward to with the opening and the unveiling of the penguins as well?
It's going to be the reaction of the public. It's always something very fun. People are always thrilled with our collection. And it's like almost like a Christmas present for the community. We just can't wait to show what we have.
Emmanuel Gardnier is the general manager of the 21C Hotel in Bentonville. He spoke to Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda last week. Residents can vote for the penguin's color at facebook.com/21C Museum Hotels. 21C is not just about penguins, of course. The hotel and restaurant are hiring, and a job fair associated with the hotel, restaurant, and bar continues until 5 today and again tomorrow at the Student Union Building on the University of Arkansas campus. Tomorrow's hours from 9 until 5.
On Talk of the Nation, we tackle the day's issues and discuss the topics that matter to you. We take the time to explore every angle of a story, and we do it all live with your help. Find out what everyone is talking about. I'm Neil Conan. Tune in and join the conversation next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon at 1 on KUAF 91.3 FM. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. It's the last Tuesday of the month, and we use this day every month to survey the upcoming theater offerings in the region. In a moment, a holiday standard at the oldest community theater venue in northwest Arkansas, the Art Center of the Ozarks. We'll go backstage as the ACO readies, once again, the best Christmas pageant ever. First, some of the other productions on the horizon, most of them holiday-flavored. Theater Squared presents its second show of the season, Period of Adjustment, billed as the only comedy Tennessee Williams ever wrote. If you'd like to know more about the production, you can join me tonight at Fayetteville Public Library at 6:30 for a free public discussion about the show with members of cast and crew. Period of Adjustment will open December 6th at Nadine Baum Studios, and the run will continue through December 30th. You can learn more at theater2.org. Rogers Little Theater will stage a modern twist on a holiday staple. A Christmas Carol Today opens December 7th and runs through the 16th. More details at rogerslittletheater.org. Back by popular demand next month is the Ceramic Cow Productions' The Santa Land Diaries. Based on the writings of humorist and essayist David Sedaris, the script may not be for all ages, but in the hands of Mark Landon Smith, the laughs rarely stop. The Santa Land Diaries are at the UARC Bowl on Dixon Street in Fayetteville, December 13th through the 15th, and the production comes complete with a cash bar and, again, intended for mature elves only. More information available at ceramiccowproductions.org. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith Academy of the Arts will bring Beauty and the Beast to the stage at Breedlove Auditorium, December 14th, 15th, and 16th. You can find out more about that production at uafs.edu/academy. If you celebrate Christmas, you probably have some personal or family traditions, a certain meal for the Christmas dinner, a special ornament for the tree, or the communal viewing of a favorite holiday movie. For many, here the Art Center of the Ozarks annual production of the best Christmas pageant ever is a tradition. This year, the latest edition of the ACO production will be staged three times for the public between December 7th and 9th in Springdale.
Kind of a gift to the community. We have a lot of community folks in it, but it really is a very special play. So a lot of folks get to come and see it, and it's always a lot of fun.
Harry Blundell is the director of theater at ACO and the production director for the 2012 Best Christmas Pageant Ever.
So when I say get in your lineup and your order off stage, you need to be in this order so that when you come on stage, you'll already be in place. That way you don't have to run up and down.
Harry has directed the play at ACO before, several times, actually. The center's archives list the play first produced there in 1989 and every single season since 1997. It puts the community in community theater. This year's cast, at least 70 strong, 62 children and 8 adults. Harry Blundell says past casts have been as big as 80, and many of the younger cast members have made the play a tradition of their own, coming back to the stage as long as their age will allow.
I've had some children who'll start at 8, which is the minimum age they have to be, and I've had some cry at 15 because they have to leave, not because I tell them to, but they self-stop. When they start looking at themselves and they look at everyone else and they say, I don't look like these children anymore, then they kind of self-stop, opt out.
The best Christmas pageant ever doesn't start out as that. Here's the synopsis. Panic erupts when the Herdman family invades their church's local Christmas pageant. The Herdman children are rude, they're crude, and they take an odd approach to the Christmas story. Rehearsals are destroyed, fire is started, and the pageant begins to list toward cancellation. How things get back on track is the heart of the story. Appropriately billed as a family-friendly script, this year's edition even includes a family, the Gates.
My name is Madison Gates, and I'm a Sunday school kid.
Debbie Gates, Mrs. Bradley.
Ernie Gates, Mr. Bradley.
I'm Matthew Gates, and I'm Max.
If you're not doing the math, that's about 6% of this year's cast. The Gates family involvement began when Matthew Gates earned a role in the 2008 production. He returned in 2009, then younger sister Madison joined the cast the next year, and last year, all the Gates were in. Matthew says he didn't so much as recruit his sister, mother, and father, as much as they observed the fun he was having.
Sort of. I guess after they watched the rehearsals after a while, I guess we all kind of thought it'd be kind of fun to get in and do this as a family.
Matthew had been in a few productions before his first Christmas pageant role. Madison had taken some summer workshops at ACO, but Mom and Dad?
Well, the past
we are 2 years...
We
are truly community actors.
Yes,
we'll put it
that absolutely.
We have a lot of fun together.
Yes.
The person. Hopefully our personalities will come out. You know, we've been married 28 years, and so hopefully some of that'll come out. It's been a lot of we've had a lot of fun with Even at Home, so it's been fun.
Even though Harry Blundell has been directing versions of the best Christmas pageant ever, he insists each year is different for him because the cast turnover creates an entirely new atmosphere. And what about those large casts? Many of those new faces. Can a director truly be expected to memorize more than 5 dozen young actors in time for the opening curtain? Name tags help. But Harry Blundell says every year the production comes together as a genuine team effort.
You know, I know the story inside and out, and by the time the kids get to performance, all 62 of these children will know each other's lines. So even on the dark years that I've had to excuse a cast member for some reason, or I might have had a cast member who got ill all of a sudden and had to replace a line part, it's usually pretty easy to choose someone in the show. And overnight, they'll know exactly what's going on because they're so involved. And this is a story that kids read in the school system all the time. So lots of children are already familiar with this play before they get to the Art Center.
The auditions for the Best Christmas Pageant are held each September and are a fairly uncomplicated process. Young actors show up at the ACO, fill out a form, recite a few lines, and sing a few bars of A Christmas Carol.
And if they can do all of those things, they usually are an automatic fit for the show because most of the parts in the show are really angels and shepherds, the Sunday school kids that support the rest of the action. So that's a pretty good thing. And then usually around the end of October, 1st of November, we'll start rehearsals, and it's kind of a hit or miss for a week or so while we're trying to miss some of our other productions and trying to fit these rehearsals in. But by the time we get to mid-November, it's pretty much about 2.5 weeks of every night. Outside the Thanksgiving holiday, which always falls the week before we open the show.
What's more fun, being a good kid on stage or an honorary kid?
Honorary.
Honorary. What's more about being honorary?
For me, it was fun because I got to do a lot of things that I'm not allowed to do off the stage. So all the stuff I wanted to do, I could do.
You can see the ornery Herdman kids turn Christmas expectations upside down again this year at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. The story of the Best Christmas Pageant Ever remains the same, but the cast changes. And this year, patrons for the play will be inside a newly remodeled ACO.
Because over the last long year. But over the last 6 months, we've been really working hard to do some revitalization here at the Art Center. So when people come see the show this year, they'll be walking into a relatively new space. If they remember what it was like, even in October, when we did American Girl on October the 5th, on October the 8th, we started this revive process and opened a show on the 26th of October. And people walked into a new facility, basically. So lots of fun and lots of new things for people to look at.
The best Christmas pageant ever will be presented to the public Friday and Saturday nights, December 7th and 8th at 7:30, and Sunday afternoon, December 9th at 3. More information can be found at artscenteroftheozarks.org.
Guys, remember, you need to sign in, and we're going to go out there. I think a few of you might still need to visit with Kathy about...
And one more production note. Yesterday, on our noon show, I gave the incorrect start time for the Ozarks Chorale performance at the Jones Center for Families in Springdale Friday night. The program begins at 7. So again, please note that the Ozarks Chorale will be at the Jones Center for Families at 7 Friday night. Garrison Keillor in the Writer's Almanac is just ahead on KUAF. But now, after 2 days of teasing, we will actually ask a question that could win you 2 tickets to opening night of Billy Elliot at Walton Arts Center. The tickets will be waiting for you at Will Call on Tuesday, December 4th. Not only will you receive 2 tickets to the opening night of Billy Elliot at Walton Arts Center, you'll also receive 4 passes that are good at any Malco movie theater in the area, and the 2013 edition of the Tim Ernst calendar. Okay, so for Billy Elliot tickets, movie tickets, and the 2013 Tim Ernst calendar, here we go. Inspired by the movie Lincoln, which has been in wide release for a little over a week now, one of the figures depicted in that movie, of course, is General Grant, the leader of the Union Army during the Civil War. Grant, of course, later became president. In fact, a dozen generals in the U.S. Army would later become president of the United States. Mention Grant, George Washington, of course, and Dwight Eisenhower. Eliminate those three. That leaves 9 others who became president after serving as a general. Can you name 2 of those 9? If you can, send your answer to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. If you have a correct answer, your name will go into the ceramic cow. And please, if you can, give us your full name, not just your email handle. All correct answers go into the ceramic cow. Then we'll pull one tomorrow morning, and that winner receives 2 tickets to Billy Elliot opening night, Tuesday, December 4th. Those will be at Will Call at Walton Arts Center. The tickets from the Malco Movie Theaters and the Tim Ernst calendar will be mailed to you. So good luck. Again, 2 of the other 9 generals who became president, eliminating Washington, Grant, and Eisenhower. The email address again, ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. Thanks and best of luck.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 27th of November, 2012. It was on this day, 1786, the poet Robert Burns borrowed a pony and made his way from his home in Ayrshire to the city of Edinburgh. He was a failure at farming, and after he got his girlfriend Jean Armour pregnant, he decided he needed to find a way to support the new family. He already had an illegitimate 1-year-old daughter, whose mother was a servant in the Burns household, and she wanted some money. So he accepted a friend's offer to go to work in the Caribbean as a clerk in Jamaica, and he was all set to leave in September. A few weeks before his departure, he published poems chiefly in the Scottish dialect, hoping to raise enough money to pay his fare. And the book became so successful that Burns began to doubt that he should leave Scotland. And then Jean Armour gave birth to twins. And at the same time, Burns heard that his book of poems had been favorably received by some influential critics in Edinburgh. And so, full of hope, he borrowed the pony he made the 2-day trip to Edinburgh. Along the way, he was entertained by farmers who had heard about him and who wanted to take him in for the night and to give big feasts in his honor. And he arrived in Edinburgh to find out that he was now famous in Scotland, and the trip to Jamaica was canceled. It's the birthday of the historian Charles A. Beard, born Knightstown, Indiana, 1874, who argued in his book An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution that the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution as a way to protect their own economic interests more than for any ideological reasons. And he also saw the Civil War not as a war that was about slavery, but as a conflict between the agricultural economy of the South and the industrialized economy of the North. It's the birthday of James Agee, born in Knoxville, 1909, best remembered for his autobiographical novel A Death in the Family and his account of Southern sharecroppers during the Dust Bowl, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. But during his life, he was best known as a film critic for The Nation and for Time magazine. And it's the birthday of the filmmaker Les Blank, born in Tampa, 1935, studied English, wanted to be a writer. Everything he wrote was rejected. He stayed in graduate school, wanted to become a teacher, but then his marriage failed and he didn't feel like studying anymore. He dropped out, couldn't find a job doing anything. And then he saw a film by Ingmar Bergman, The Seventh Seal, and it changed his life. He decided to become a filmmaker. Les Blank has made more than 40 films, many of them documentaries about different traditional musicians, Cajun music, the blues, cowboy music, the polka, a film about garlic, and about a man who buys tea in China and brings it back to San Francisco. Here's a poem for today by Robert Bly, entitled Taking the Hands. Taking the hands of someone you love, you see they are delicate cages. Tiny birds are singing in the secluded prairies and in the deep valleys of the hand. Robert Bly's poem, Taking the Hands, from Silence in the Snowy Fields, published by Wesleyan University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses leverage a powerful form of advertising, online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. Written by Betsy Alistair, produced by Nick Vedder. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Paris. And again, an invitation to join me and members of cast and crew of Period of Adjustment tonight at the Fayetteville Public Library. It's a free presentation discussing Tennessee Williams' play that is the next production in the Theater Squared season. You will also be able to see a sneak preview of the production. It begins at 6:30 in the Walker Community Room at Fayetteville Public Library. It is open to the public and it is absolutely free. And we'll get you out just in time to maybe be able to go a few blocks east to catch Adam Vines at the Nightbird Books presentation, monthly presentation of Ozark Poets and Writers Collective. Adam Vines is a professor at Alabama Birmingham. He is the featured speaker tonight. His collection, The Coal Life Poems, was a finalist for the University of Arkansas Press's 2012 Miller Williams Prize. He'll read from his work tonight at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street. That begins at 7. That, too, is absolutely free. And again, it's sponsored by the Ozark Poets and Writers Collective. Stay tuned because in a few days, a conversation with Adam Vines will be on Ozarks at Large as well. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF 91.3 FM. I'm Kyle Kellums. I'll be back with you tomorrow for a brand new edition of the program. Christina Thomas will be back with me in the studio on Thursday. Thanks so much. And once again, don't forget you can enter for the Billy Elliot tickets as well as the Malco movie tickets and the Tim Earns calendar by giving your answer at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. Name two of the nine generals who became president, not counting Washington, Eisenhower, or Grant. This is Ozarks at Large. Have a great Tuesday.